This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course on the air right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio. Ever since Al Gore invented the internet, you remember him, people have been trying to figure out exactly what to do with it. See, we can put pictures on it, maybe pictures of babies holding beer bottles or, you know, horses kicking people. And finally, colleges and universities stepped up and created virtual classrooms, and thus online education was born. And that's exactly how it went. It's an affordable, easily accessible conduit to higher education. But will their creation now jeopardize brick-and-mortar colleges? Director of Research from Bloomberg Government, Mr. Bob Lighton, is here. How are you?
Hi, good to talk to you, Alan.
Nice talking to you, too. So you've recently penned a study here, Online Courses Threaten Brick-and-Mortar Colleges. And was that an accurate assessment? That it very well could close the doors of a lot of schools.
Well, it's a threat if the schools don't embrace it. And I think the most survivable model is some kind of blend,
where you have
in-person instruction paired with online. But that isn't to say that pure online won't succeed, because in fact, it's already succeeding in the marketplace.
School is expensive, especially if you have kids in college. Private school's expensive. Forget about that. Elementary school, you can go to a private school and pay a lot of money. I went to a private high school, and it was, you know, more than a lot of really luxury vehicles that people are driving around these days per year. So the end result of people going and pulling out student loans, if they're not fortunate enough to have the parents pay for it for them, the end result is going to be a lot of debt, a lot of debt. And the president has now finally realized that this is becoming an issue. It's actually detrimental to the economy.
Sure it is, because when kids come out of college with a lot of debt, especially if they don't have any jobs, which about a quarter of them don't about now, but even if they do get jobs, you're talking about kids after they get married, they're unable to buy a house because they're saddled with student debt. And yet one of the shocking things, if you look at the data, is that on average, over the last 30 or 40 years, the cost of going to college has risen faster than healthcare, which is a remarkable statistic. Now, of course, that isn't true for everybody because, you know, some people get need-based aid, and but we're talking about the average price. And the average price has escalated at a very, very rapid clip.
You've got a little thing in here in your study that says, and I quote, "Still, it's worrisome for many graduates and their families that 40% of households headed by someone older than 35 is still paying off student loans in 2012. And that's an increase of 34% from 2007. That's startling.
Well, absolutely. And of course, that reflects the fact, A, that more people are going to school, and B, that because of the recession, a lot of kids, I think, stay on longer. Or they go to an additional program, they take graduate school, or they go to professional school hoping that they're going to land a better job. Of course, you know, by the way, a lot of those kids that went to law school in the hopes of getting a better job then end up incurring a lot of student debt, and they can't get jobs afterwards. So this rising cost problem, I think, is a major contributor to the interest in online. But I think we'd have interest in online independent of cost. It's just that with the rising cost, you've got this cheaper technology that's getting better and better, and people are expressing greater interest in it. And one important thing that I want to stress from our study is that a lot of people identify online with just for-profit schools. And there's been a lot of concern about for-profit schools ripping people off. In other words, enticing people to come to school, take out a loan, then there's no job at the end of the line, and meanwhile the kids are stuck with a lot of debt. And the administration, and particularly the Department of Education, has been cracking down on for-profit schools. But I want to make very clear that this phenomenon of online education is independent of for-profit schools. We see a lot of nonprofit sites, for example, like the Khan Academy or Udacity, or even major universities now that are offering what are called MOOCs, these massive online courses. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of nonprofits that have embraced online education, and it's way beyond the for-profit phenomenon.
So the president's finally realized the cost of higher education is really breaking banks and scaring a lot of people into reconsidering whether they even want to go, because there is no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for a lot of people, especially with the economy the way it is today. So he is now encouraging those to revisit the way this $150 million, billion dollars is being distributed to colleges and universities. And that is that mix that you referred to a little while ago. Do they have that right mix of online versus brick and mortar course load available?
Yeah, he wants to actually change the criteria for granting student loans to take into account value and affordability. And historically, in order to get financial aid, you had to be attending what's called an accredited university. Mm-hmm. Now, guess who controls the accreditation? It's the colleges.
Right.
So they obviously, up to now, have not had a great incentive to let new technologies in. But the president has suggested that, you know, if we don't have accreditation organizations recognizing online education, perhaps we ought to look to alternative sources of accreditation. But, you know, even if we don't have accredited universities giving credit for online courses, I think over time, outfits like the Khan Academy or Udacity, some of the very well-known online providers that are nonprofit, I think they will develop their own certifications that will be recognized by employers. And they'll develop these relationships with employers, probably at the beginning in very commercial activities that you can easily ascertain the quality of the person's education, for example, like in computer programming. Mm-hmm. We may see these certifications replace or at least supplement the conventional college certificate.
Coming up in a little while here on Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, we're going to have Dr. Marie Sini, who is the Senior Vice President and Provost at the University of Maryland University College, a college that has prided itself on adult education or alternative education, so to speak. And they offer a very large online component. Rumor has it, and I'll confirm this with her, it's close to 80% of the course load out there is available online, and you can get an entire degree, walk through your entire degree program online, never stepping foot into a classroom. So that lends itself to the question, are they saving money by offering more online courses? Do they still need to provide the same number of instructors on the back end? Don't have to worry about dorms. Don't have to worry about
right.
A lot of the things that are causing the cost of college now to go up. A college now has to have amenities galore to even attract a person, regardless of what their grades are.
Yeah, and so that's a big part of the competition among colleges is the arms race in amenities. Fancy dorms, fancy food, fancy gyms, and so forth. And I'm not saying that that's going to disappear, because it won't. There'll be a lot of parents that'll want to get their kids out of the house. and there'll be a lot of kids that'll want to have a social experience. But we're going to have to separately value that social experience from the actual educational experience. And for a lot of families, they may not want or they may not want to choose to spend all that money on a quasi-vacation as opposed to just pure education. And I think one possible scenario is that we see a lot of students coming out of high school, maybe taking their first year or two at a community college or even staying at home or having alternative residential facility, where they take a lot of their basic instructional courses, basic calculus, basic physics, science, and so forth. They take that online, but then they go and in residence go to a college for the last 2 years.
Right.
Because there is a value, obviously,
sure,
in having peers, in having conversation with the professor, and so forth. But a lot of these basic courses where kids go and they're sitting in a lecture hall with 500 or 600 kids, why is that better than taking a course online? And you can do this at your own pace at home. Now, one of the things I do in my study is, you know, I look out far enough, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, And one of the things that we have when we have new technologies, we tend to overstate their impact in the short run, but we understate their impact in the long run. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the internet, it's a perfect example. People were euphoric, they're going crazy, how it's going to change the world in 1996, 97, and it took a while. And now it's 2013, and it has changed the world.
Definitely.
All right, but you know what? I think people would, back in 1996, probably would have understated its impact today if they knew what had happened. I think the same thing is going to happen with online education. Because one of the implications of not going to school for a year or two is, what are we going to do with all those dorms and those buildings?
Just about to ask you. So what happens 10, 15 years down the road when the internet blows up even more than it already has? Colleges and universities are now practically virtual only, exclusive. What's going to happen to those schools with those fancy dorms?
Well, I think they're going to have to repurpose their buildings. And I venture one guess in the paper. I can see enterprising universities retrofitting their dorms into reasonably nice condominiums and enticing their alumni to come back and live on the university campus. A lot of people have loyalty to where they went to school. And there's a lot of things to do in a university town. Plus, there's a lot of culture at a university. There are sports events. Your whole life can be there. And so that's one way to repurpose. And then you can take the buildings where there are a lot of the classrooms used to be held, and you have classrooms and other activities for people that are in their 65 or 70-year-old age group. So let's think expansively. I mean, we're not going to let just have these buildings rot. They're going to be enterprising people that are going to figure out something else to do with these buildings.
I'm smiling because I just can't see myself back at Carruthers Hall at Salisbury University hanging out with all my friends going, so we're going to head back to Sullivan and do, that is amazing. That's a really good idea. I never would have thought of that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of schools that are already doing that, but they're doing it by attracting people to neighboring locations.
Right.
And, you know, you can go into fancy villa this and so forth in gated community. Well, you know, to heck with that. Why don't you just come back and live on campus? You know, and now I know a lot of people will say, oh my goodness, I don't want to be 18 or 22 years old again. But with a nice enough condo, you know, you're free of the kids, and you decide, where would I rather have my condo, in the middle of New York or Chicago, or I go back to Ann Arbor or to pick your place, you know?
That's pretty
and,
funny.
And you know what? And these communities are safe. And and there's a lot of interesting things. Plus, you know, there's advantage in being around a lot of young people, too. So I think the world could change.
You know what? I'm with you on that. That's a great idea. I thoroughly think that that is entirely possible. Bob, any parting thoughts before we bid you adieu?
To tell people that there's a lot of opportunities right now on the web, and I'm going to give them some places that they can go. And their minds will be blown. So go to Khan Academy, K-H-A-N Academy, and look at it. There are over 3,000 10-minute lectures, and you can learn almost anything from K through 12 through college through graduate school. You can go to Coursera, which is C-O-U-R-S-E-R-A, or you can go to Udacity, and you can take six-week courses led by some of the best professors in the world, and you can do this all online. And you can have a great experience. And you know what? These are the Model T's of online education. Imagine what it's going to be like in 5 or 10 years. It's going to be even more amazing. But right now, you don't have to wait for that. You can start educating yourself.
Director of Research, Mr. Bob Lighton. The study is called Rise of Online Courses, Promises to Reshape U.S. Higher Education. Bob, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. As we continue our online education conversation, I'd like to welcome Dr. Marie Sini to the program. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, it's very nice to be here.
Well, thank you for being a part of the program, especially in light of the news. I'm holding the press release in my hand right here. Did you hear that? That's me ruffling the press release. Dr. Marie Sini named top academic post at the University of Maryland, University College, Adelphi, Maryland. Congratulations. That is an amazing feat.
Thank you. I am very honored, to have been selected.
And I'm glad that we have you on the phone here because according to this press release, you are a nationally recognized expert in technology, among other things, many other things. And that's why I wanted to talk to you because online education is what we're talking about here today. First off, University of Maryland, University College, gigantic, 170 locations, 28 different countries. You're kind of a busy woman these days.
Yes. We're all very busy. Yeah, we all are. But, you know, the people who work here are so great, and we're so dedicated to our mission that it's actually, you know, no job is easy, but it's easier being with all these great folks who really care about our students.
I'm glad you mentioned mission, because that was my next question. Give me an idea of what the University of Maryland University College mission actually is.
Yeah, our mission really is for the state of Maryland and the nation and really the world is to be a top provider of accessible, affordable education for adult and non-traditional students. Our DNA, I like to say that our DNA is with adult students because we started in 1947 serving military veterans who came back from World War II. So we've never been a traditional university with residence halls, et cetera. We always go where the students are.
That is an amazing feat, especially given the amount of money it costs for a student these days to actually go to a brick and mortar institution. And you, specializing in the adult or non-traditional education, have found a nice mix. I think I mentioned to you that my wife actually attended University of Maryland University College as she was going back and getting her bachelor's and then transferred off to UMAB to finish her nursing degree. But online education is a key element in that mission that you have. Give me an idea of the percentage of online versus classroom work and the difference between the two.
Well, our students, I mean, it's interesting. We didn't start out as an online institution. Obviously, we're older than that. But in the 90s, we moved to online because it was sort of the next generation of accessible, affordable methods that students could access education. And so now, at any given time, about 85% of our students are online. It's really the minority of students that are taking face-to-face or hybrid courses. So that gives you an example of, you know, how big the online part of it became.
Does that change the makeup of, over the course of time, let's say in the 90s when the online boom hit and the ability for a school like yours to pull up a Blackboard and conduct that online course, does that change the makeup of the staff? Give me an idea of behind the scenes. Are you looking at more or fewer staff than you had previously? Are you able to save money, make money?
Yeah, people always think you can save money online. In fact, if you do online correctly, it's probably equally expensive to do education well because, you know, we have to design those courses. We don't want we offer so many sections of courses. We don't want students going in and getting a variable experience. Like there's one really great course, well designed, and then one course that isn't so good. So we really try to have a consistent look and feel and pedagogy. We have to offer and want to offer all the traditional student support services that you would find at a traditional university. So our students can pay their bill online, register online, they can access an advisor, you know, almost all parts of the day and major chunks of the weekend. We have to have tech support that students can call 24/7.
Right.
You know, the list goes on and on. We have I haven't checked this, but I believe it's one of the largest online writing centers in the country, so students can submit a paper and get feedback on how they're doing with their writing. So, in fact, it's actually kind of expensive to do it the right way.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We're speaking with Dr. Marie Sini. She is the Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of Maryland University College. And you've got a long pedigree of sheepskin behind your name. You know, you've got the doctor. You went to the University of Pittsburgh. You've done the education thing, most of it, I would imagine, prior to the advent or Al Gore's invention of the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yes.
So you and I both know what it's like to actually go to a library and actually do research and pull papers and such. With the president realizing that money has become an issue for people trying to attend school. He's now taking that $150 billion of federal grant aid and saying, he's proposing, let's say, to take a look at the makeup of those colleges and universities to make sure they're offering more affordable content. In your case, of more than 80% of your course load now being available online, you kind of want to stick out your chest and go, you know what, we've already done it.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of advice would you pass along to your peers who may not necessarily be in the same seat that you're in?
Yeah, I think one of the things, and many institutions are doing this, even our more traditional brick and mortar institutions, you need to really ask what is the educational experience? What adds to students' education versus, you know, services that are kind of nice to have but maybe don't always support what the students are doing to learn. So, you know, I think everything is, as they say, an empirical question. I think one of the things we do here is try to use data to make decisions. So rather than saying, well, gee, students learn better if there are X number of students in a course, we believe that's true, we try to test that. One of the things that all universities could do better is to use data to make their decisions and not to make assumptions about what works or what doesn't work, because at the end of the day, it has to all be about student learning.
Math never goes away, does it?
Math, no, it only gets more and more, really. I know, if you don't like math, well, sorry, it's even more important these days.
That's pretty funny. So are you, how far along in the education are you able to go? Let's say I'm walking in and I've got a few credits under my belt and I want to try to get my bachelor's or associate's, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. How far along through that process can I do it online? Is there a point at which I have to actually step into a classroom?
No. You can, all of our programs are entirely online should you want to take it that way. In fact, it's much, if you walked in and said, hey, I want to take my program completely face-to-face, we would have a harder time accommodating that kind of student. So, no, you come in and you can be online immediately.
Bob Lighton, Bloomberg Government's Director of Research, wrote a study that said there's some colleges and universities out there that may not be able to meet those standards mm-hmm. and may end up out of business in the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
That's got to be disheartening, but then exciting for you at the same time, knowing that you're already meeting the criteria. Sad that your peers some of your peers may be unemployed mm-hmm. As a result of an inability to meet the new standards. But at the same time, hey, here we are as your alternative.
Well, you're right. I have mixed emotions. Look, I've attended large state universities. I've worked at smaller private universities, and many of these smaller universities do a wonderful job with students, but their economic model is difficult to sustain. You know, people don't have the large amounts of tuition to pay, and so it is very sad that smaller schools might be closing. What I'm hoping is that we can start thinking about more consortia of schools. So if smaller schools, you know, would like to get more into the online world and have programs that maybe they can share with other schools, there might be ways to save more of the schools by, you know, creating more efficiencies, and I would hope we can do that. At the same time, I agree with you. We are very happy that we got into online education in the 90s when we did.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm happy you did too, and I'm happy that the bills that I helped my wife pay weren't that large.
Oh, so, good. We try to keep it that way.
So I'm very happy with that. Dr. Marie Cini, she is the Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of Maryland University College. What's the web address where people can find out more?
Oh, www.umuc.edu.
Dr. Cini, thank you very much for being a part of the program.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
I'm sure you've been in a situation where someone felt as though they've been disrespected and eventually threw out that, "Do you know who I am?" statement. Could have been at work, maybe a restaurant or a hotel. Regardless of the situation, the recipient's blood will typically begin to boil. Reese Witherspoon, while watching her husband being investigated for DUI, uttered those words this week and found herself wearing some pretty metal bracelets in Atlanta and taking a ride in a nice Chevy Impala with lights. That lends itself to the question, the people on the receiving end of that, how do they truly feel? What are they thinking? Bloomberg Businessweek's Keenan Mayo asked that question and got some interesting responses from people who find themselves face to face with those who feel you should know who they are. See what they said on Bloomberg's businessweek.com. And with that, we put the pin in another edition of Capital Impact. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at BGov, and while you're at it, you can follow me at Alan L. Scott. Also, like us on Facebook, as we throw a lot of content out there you won't find anywhere else. We'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.